The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Judge Motz, you can proceed.
Oh, thank you very much. We'd be delighted to hear argument in number 182438, Attix Energy S.A. versus MBA Yasa H. Mullah. Counsel? Mr. Power?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. This is James Power, counsel for Yasa Mullah Appellant. As we've set forth in our briefs, we believe there are five areas in which the district judge erred. In particular, I'll go through the following. Several of the issues, which if found in favor of appellant, would moot the remaining issues. So I will focus on the ones that are 100% dispositive, which is 100% dispositive of the case. First and foremost, we believe that the district court lacked admiralty jurisdiction to issue a warrant of arrest against the vessel, as the claims brought by Attix were not maritime claims, but were merely claims arising from a breach of a settlement agreement, which does not confer maritime jurisdiction or federal subject matter jurisdiction of the court. The second issue is, we believe, that the district court erred in granting a U.S. maritime lien pursuant to the U.S. Maritime Lien Act. Thirdly, and another dispositive issue, is that Attix did not have standing to bring the claim where the very invoices in which it issued to the purchaser of the fuel stated that it assigned the rights to the receivables.
Mr. Power, this is Judge Agee. Let me stop you at the standing point. Obviously, if ADAX does not have standing, there isn't much more that we could do now. But I noticed in your briefs that between the opening and reply, you spent only three pages combined with regard to the standing argument, which would seem to me to be the absolute threshold for our determination of the case. Could you tell us in a little more detail exactly why ADAX does not have standing, and if they don't, what we should do about it?
Yes, Your Honor. In terms of the standing, the invoice itself, ADAX has the burden of proving that it has standing. In the very document that ADAX attached to its complaint, namely the invoice, it expressly states on there that the right to collect the receivables has been assigned. The reason we didn't go through in further detail in our papers is that there isn't much more to say about it. We think it's simple on its face. Their own documents have established that they have assigned the right to collect the receivables. And according to the case law that we've cited, that when you assign the right to collect those receivables, you no longer have a right to pursue a maritime lien because the lien and the debt are intertwined at that point.
Okay,
well, Mr. Powell,
excuse me.
Who's going first?
You go ahead, please.
All right, this is Judge Agee again. If you look at the invoice and then the 30B6 witness's testimony, I can't determine exactly what the degree of assignment is, which I would think would be relevant to the determination of standing. If a party's made a complete assignment so that they've basically and unequivocally given up all their rights with respect to a particular object, then normally the assignor would not have standing to sue an obligor. But if the assignment is only in part, then it's an open question as to whether the assignor has retained sufficient rights to continue to have standing. So when I look at the invoice and the 30B6 testimony, I can't tell what the degree of assignment is. So maybe you can give us some further delineation of that. But if we don't know whether or not ADAX has assigned all of its rights so that it extinguishes its standing, wouldn't we have to send this back to the district court to make that determination in the first instance?
Yes, Your Honor. If the court felt that it was unable to determine on its face with the express language of the invoice to what degree an assignment was made, I think we made the point that the invoice itself to us certainly seems pretty clear. They've assigned the receivables. That is the express statement on the invoice included in one of the only exhibits. When we sought the deposition of the 30B6 witness, that witness was not capable of offering any further testimony as to whether or not it was something less than a full assignment.
Well, Mr. Power, this is Judge Keenan. Isn't it really more the testimony, though, of the 30B6 witness that it's not clear whether there was an assignment at all? That the 30B6 witness said you just couldn't speak to it. Essentially, this is something they put on their invoices, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't, in fact, an assignment. And let me ask you to also address, when you answer my question, the distinction between a real party and interest in standing. Is this really an issue of standing, or rather a question under the federal rules of whether ADAX is the party which has the right to bring this lawsuit? In other words, are they the real party in interest? I mean, the court clearly has admiralty jurisdiction. The question is, who is the real party in interest, isn't it? Whether it's ADAX or if there has been an assignment, the S&E.
Yeah, I think if they've assigned the right to collect the debt, in other words, they no longer own that right, then they no longer are the proper party with standing to assert a maritime lien. And this is, we did touch on this in our briefing, because there's been recent cases, including the cases that we've cited, is that, you know, typically when these fuel supplies are financed by third parties. When a third party finances the fuel supply, they want all the rights and remedies immediately assigned so that they can go pursue if the payment isn't made. So usually in the terms, and again, those documents were not produced, but in the terms of these agreements with the sellers, someone like ADAX, it is not atypical to have assigned the rights over, just as in the case that we cited before the court in our brief. And
Mr. Power, this is Judge Agee again. I don't want to belabor this to the exclusion of all your other arguments, but when I look at the invoice, it just says this invoice has been assigned in accordance with our legal and contractual obligations. Well, we don't have any idea what those legal and contractual obligations are and the extent to which it constitutes an assignment, which the 30B6 witness confirmed. So in that circumstance, while certainly ADAX has the burden, if we are unable to determine whether or not they're standing here, don't we have to get to the bottom of that by sending it back to the district court to make that determination on the record?
Yes, I think you would. However, I do think that the 30B6 witness's inability to disclaim or to make a contrary statement that the receivables were not assigned, as stated in the invoice, precludes really any further analysis into the issue. I mean, that was the point of the 30B6. If the 30B6 did not know and couldn't provide counter information and evidence against the plain language of the invoice, then we think that there really needs to be no further analysis, that it simply should be found that there was no standing based on the document itself
and the statement that the receivables have been assigned.
That answers my question. I don't want to belabor this so that Mr. Power can move on.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Just one more question about this. This is Judge Moss. So your argument is that the other side can't enforce the maritime lien because they assertedly have no standing, right?
Yes, that is correct. They've expressly stated that they've assigned the right to the receivables.
Yeah, I know. Okay. But Addix suffered an injury in fact when it provided the vessel with fuel. It did not receive full compensation, right?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know whether they've suffered an injury in fact, because it became irrelevant once the settlement agreement was made. And in fact...
No. Leave aside the settlement agreement for a minute. We're just talking about... Now we're talking there about their ability to show an injury in fact. So this is prior to the settlement agreement. They didn't get paid for the fuel, right?
Yeah, well, Your Honor, again, if they assigned the receivables, they weren't supposed to be paid for the... I mean, in other words, they might have been collecting it, but they were collecting it on behalf of someone else. So then they did not incur any injury. That injury was to a third party who was the only one that would have standing.
Okay, Mr. Power, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Judge Moss, go ahead, please.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Power, see, I'm worried about you characterizing this as standing and bringing it into the jurisdictional realm. It seems to me that it is a real party and interest question under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 17, and that the vessel, as Judge Mott says, plaintiff, Addix, as Judge Mott says, can say, we provided the fuel, we didn't get paid. And then you come back and say, no, even though you provided the fuel, you're not the real party in interest in this case. And it would then be your burden to establish that Addix is not the real party in interest, as opposed to trying to call this an issue of standing and tag Addix with the responsibility of showing that they didn't assign it. It seems to me there's a serious burden of proof issue in terms of whether you call this standing or real party in interest, and I'd really like to have you address that distinction.
Sure. Yes, Your Honor, and I would agree with you, but for the fact that Addix itself has presented to the court what I would say is now burden shifting, is they've represented themselves that the receivables have been assigned. This isn't a case where the contract is silent. If that were the case, I would agree. I would have the burden. But here, the information itself presented to the court in the first instance by Addix using their own document says the receivables have been assigned. So the burden remains on them because of that fact. Now, you know, had they not done that, I would agree with you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
My countdown clock is 2 minutes. Should I continue to focus on this issue, or should I move to the issue of the settlement agreement?
Talk about whatever issue you wish to talk about.
Yes. Okay. Yes. The next issue, which would move all other issues, is whether the court has subject matter jurisdiction. We believe the case law is clear, on point, and we've referenced it in our briefs, that even assuming that once the settlement agreement was executed between the parties, which covers the debt, and the express language of the settlement agreement itself, which is joint appendix 138 to 141, refers to the subject matter as the debt, which is the amount that was owed under the supply agreement. So the settlement agreement also expressly states in clause 13 that it supersedes and extinguishes all previous agreements. The agreement is governed by Swiss law. There is no reference to maritime liens or preserving liens. So therefore, we believe the case law is clear, and it must be that once the settlement was executed, consideration paid, and performance being made, that there is no longer a right by Addix or anyone else to erect the vessel on an alleged breach of the original supply agreement.
Okay, Mr. Power, my concern with that, and this is Judge Keene again, my concern with that argument is really twofold. You've got a problem with the lien arising by operation of law, and you have the vessel not being a party to the settlement agreement. So why would we require addicts to expressly reserve its right to a statutory lien against the vessel in an agreement with another party when the lien arises separately by operation of law?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question, particularly because it's a fiction in terms of when we say, in this particular case, that the lien is arising by operation of law. The only reason that addicts is even able to assert a lien under U.S. law is because the supply contract itself, even though it's covered by English law, says that maritime liens shall be interpreted by the law of the United States. Under the Queen of Le Mans case, if that single clause was in there, there would be no question that addicts would never have been able to even assert a maritime lien against this vessel while it was in U.S. waters. So because of that unique contract form that addicts included in its supply contract, the terms of the contract itself are the only enabler that allows addicts to have a lien, as there is no other connection to the United States but for the clause stating that the liens arise under the supply agreement are governed by U.S. law. So addicts chose to use the supply contract to allow itself to assert a maritime lien. We were not a party to that contract either, yet the vessel was subject to those provisions. As such, we certainly should be able to rely upon any defenses that are available pursuant to us based upon the subsequent settlement agreement. So we cannot be held to the terms and conditions, including the U.S. lien clause in the supply contract, but then not be able to rely upon a later subsequent contract which replaced the supply agreement, which is the settlement agreement. My timer is telling me my time is done. Would you like me to proceed, or can I proceed to continue, or shall we save it for review?
Well, let me ask my colleagues if they have any questions.
No, thank you.
JG? No further at this time.
Thank you.
All right. Why don't we listen to what your colleague on the other side has to say?
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Lauren Wilgus on behalf of the appellee, Addicts Energy SA. May it please the court. Before I address the appellant's arguments concerning the party in interest and the settlement agreement, I would first just like to take a step back and just talk about this action generally. The action below was commenced by a Swiss fuel supplier, Addicts Energy, seeking recovery of payment for its provision of bunker fuel to appellant's vessel. It's undisputed that Addicts supplied the vessel with the fuel bunkers on the order of the vessel's time charter, Windrose Shipping. It's also undisputed that Windrose had legal authority from the vessel's owner to order the bunkers. Addicts thereafter issued an invoice to Windrose, and Windrose ultimately made two small payments. Under the law, at the time Addicts supplied the fuel to the vessel, two claims arose. Addicts had an in rem maritime lien claim against the vessel itself by operation of law, and Addicts had an in personam claim against the charterer under the contract. Due to Windrose's non-payment for the full amount of the fuel bunkers, Addicts pursued its in rem maritime lien claim against the vessel for the remaining amount due. To pursue its in rem maritime lien claim, Addicts arrested the vessel in the Eastern District of Virginia. By agreement, the vessel was released from arrest by the deposit of cash security into the court's registry. Now, YASA does not dispute that Addicts' provision of fuel to the ship meets the requirements for a maritime lien under the Maritime Lien Act or Rule C. Instead, YASA argues that a separate settlement agreement between Addicts and the vessel's charterer extinguished any right Addicts had to foreclose its maritime lien against the vessel, which undisputedly received and consumed the fuel and was not paid. The district court rejected YASA's position concerning the applicability of the settlement agreement to Addex's in rem claim, finding that the settlement agreement does not govern Addex's ability to pursue a maritime lien by operation of law, and Addex's attempt to secure relief by contract with WinRoads does not foreclose its distinct right to relief through an in rem claim against the vessel. The district court correctly concluded that the non-payment for the fuel resulted in an enforceable maritime lien and in rem liability against the vessel as a matter of law. Addex has a valid maritime lien against the vessel within the meaning of the Federal Maritime Lien Act. Under the law, when a maritime lien attaches, a supplier of necessaries, which Addex is in this case, may pursue both an in rem action against the vessel and an in personam action against any party who is directly liable under the contract. Fourth Circuit authority on this point is clear.
This is Judge Agee. Yep. I have a question there. So do we know on this record whether with this assignment, whether or not an assignment was made, whether it was limited to the contract receivables or whether it included all rights and interests, including the maritime lien? Because when I looked at the discussion by Mr. Robert, the 30B6 witness, it's kind of hard to tell.
Your Honor, you're talking about the real party and interest issue here, and plaintiff, the notation you're talking about is in an invoice. It's just a standard clause. Mr. Robert testified that it's just a standard clause that's inserted in Addex's invoices. There's no evidence to support the proposition that Addex assigned its claim here. The evidence actually shows that Addex was the one that pursued the collection of the debt with WinRoads. So again, just by the actions of the parties, it's clear that Addex, in fact, was pursuing the debt here. So they
the fact that Addex may have pursued the action isn't sort of an ipsa dixit that gives it standing. I mean, the district court's own finding was that the record was not clear as to whether the plaintiff had assigned its rights, and then it determined that the plaintiff had legal standing because it had pursued these claims against the ship. But it may have not had standing or been a party in interest at any point along the way, depending on what, in fact, it assigned. Because if it assigned not only its rights under the contract, but also its maritime lien, or all rights and interests that it may have had, how could it pursue the action?
Your Honor, the burden was on YASA to show that Addex did in fact assign its rights here, and in fact there was no evidence to show that it actually did. Again, the maritime lien arises under operation of law, not under the contract. So if you just take the contract away completely, Addex supplied the vessel with fuel, the fuel was used by the vessel, and Addex has a maritime lien under the law. Again, there's no evidence.
Couldn't it have assigned the maritime lien?
There is no evidence that it was assigned here, Your Honor.
Well, I understand that there isn't, which is one of the problems I think that's created here. But what I'm asking you is, would Addex have the right to assign its maritime lien?
I suppose, yes, Addex could have, but again, there's no evidence that it did.
Okay, Ms. Wilgus, this is Judge Keenan. Let me ask you a question. To what extent are you relying on the Swiss bankruptcy proceedings and the settlement agreement? Because in the settlement agreement, Addex and Winrose reached the disposition, and presumably if Addicts wasn't the real party of an interest, Winrose wouldn't have entered into any agreement. To what extent are you relying on that? I haven't heard you talk about that.
Well, again, Your Honor,
or do you think that point is relevant?
I don't think the point is relevant to Addicts' in rem maritime lien under the law against the vessel. To the extent,
yes, but is it relevant? Excuse me, I don't mean to cut across you. Is it relevant to the issue of whether, in fact, there was an whether Addicts had assigned its claim?
It's hard on the phone. I apologize.
No, my problem too. I apologize too. You go ahead.
I think the settlement agreement itself is entirely irrelevant to the claim here. To the extent it is relevant to show the actions of the parties. As I said, Addicts pursued recovery of the amounts due from Winrose. It wasn't somebody else. It wasn't, Addicts didn't say, we're doing this on behalf of some other party that we assigned our rights to. None of that has been established in any of the emails, any of the documents, any testimony in this case at all. What, again, it shows is that the evidence actually shows that Addicts pursued its right to collect the debt with Winrose. It did so in negotiations. It did so with the settlement agreement, et cetera. There's no evidence whatsoever that any other party came in here and said, wait a minute, this is actually my right to pursue recovery of this this amounts due. So to the extent the settlement agreement is relevant at all, again, it just shows that Addicts, in fact, was the one who was pursuing the debt here.
Okay, thank you.
With respect to the settlement agreement, again, as I stated, the Addicts' in rem claim against the vessel does not arise under the supply agreement or the settlement agreement with Winrose, but by operation of the law. Thus, whether the settlement agreement preserved Addicts' right to a maritime lien is legally irrelevant here. Contrary to Yasa's misrepresentation, the plain language of the settlement agreement contains an absolute reservation of Addicts' rights under the supply agreement under both Clause 3.2 and 4.1 of the settlement agreement. Your Honors, with respect to the extent appellants are going to discuss any assignment any rights to collect the lien from the Cargill assignment, which may come up. Again, the settlement agreement between Addicts and Winrose is wholly irrelevant to the in rem claim here. But even if the settlement agreement was relevant, appellant's argument concerning the Cargill assignment fails because there's no evidence whatsoever that Addicts acted in bad faith or in a manner otherwise inconsistent with its express rights under the settlement agreement. The agreement actually reserved Addicts' sole right to determine the validity of the Cargill claim. And Addicts' witness, Mr. Robert, testified that shortly after executing the settlement agreement, Addicts sought information concerning the Cargill assignment from Winrose. Was insecure about that assignment because Winrose did not provide all of the information that Addicts was seeking, and Addicts exercised its right under the settlement agreement and determined that Winrose failed to provide satisfactory information regarding the claim, and Addicts did not, in fact, accept that assignment. And finally, to the last point, to the extent appellant's argument potentially regarding any sort of double payment issue may arise, that was resolved. Addicts executed an assignment of a debt against Winrose in the Swiss bankruptcy and actually assigned YASA its right, title, and interest to any debt owed by Winrose. We checked with our client concerning status of the Swiss bankruptcy proceeding and understand that nothing has actually moved forward with that as of August when I checked with them.
Hey, Ms. Wilbur, since you're winding up, could you clarify for us what is your position with regard to the assignment language on the invoice? Did Addex assign its right to collect the invoice? Are you saying it did not assign it, or that the record does not prove whether it assigned its right? In other words, are you taking a categorical stand that Addex did not assign its right, or are you simply saying the record doesn't show that?
Your Honor, the record, the evidence in the record does not show that Addex assigned its right. As I said, the record does in fact show that Addex itself pursued collection of the debt through negotiations with Windrose, and also it pursued its rights against the vessel here. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that Addex or any assigned its rights at all, and in fact, no third party has come in at all and said, you know, wait a minute, this is actually our right to collect this debt. We produced thousands of pages of documents, which included email correspondence and contracts, et cetera. And again, the 30B6 witness. And again, there's no evidence whatsoever that anybody except Addex had a right to pursue its debt, the debt here. And again, there's no evidence.
Counsel,
that
I'm
other
still
parties.
Not exactly. Hi, this is Judge Motz. I'm not clear on what your answer was to Judge Keenan. Are you saying your client didn't assign it, or that the other side has to prove that you assigned it, and they haven't on this record?
Your Honor, I'm saying that this issue concerns whether Addex is the real party in interest in this case. The burden was on YASA to show Addex was not the real party to pursue the claim here. YASA did not meet its burden because there is no evidence in the record that Addex assigned its right under the fuel invoice.
Okay, so when the district court found as a fact that it was unclear whether your client, Addex, had assigned the lien, you think that's of no consequence, that doesn't have to be determined. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I'm saying that there is no evidence that anybody except for Addex is the real party in interest in this case.
Well, you and I both know what the district court said. It said that as a factual matter, it was unclear whether Addex had assigned the lien. But it said Addex assigned that issue is not material to Addex's right to enforce the lien.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the reason
if I could
not
ask, no, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Along this line, this is Judge Agee, as I understand the opposing counsel's brief, they represent, and you tell me if this is incorrect, they represent that they requested the district court to order the production of the assignment documents, assuming there were some, and the district court denied that motion for tardiness. Is that correct?
Your Honor, yes. YASA argued the district court did not afford it an opportunity to brief the issue concerning the party in interest standing issue. Yet, you know, YASA Shipping actually was given ample opportunity to raise the issue during discovery. It did not. It could have sought information in its discovery request. It did not. It could have sought to compel information concerning this particular issue.
Pardon me for interrupting, but my understanding, which may be incorrect, was that the opposing counsel has represented that it did request this information with respect to an assignment, which would seem to answer the questions we have today, and that request was denied. Is that factually correct?
Yes, it was given an opportunity to raise the issue in its opposition to Addicks' summary judgment motion. The district court considered the request and rejected the request.
So if this is indeed a question of standing, however that interplays with a real party in interest, isn't the court obligated to assure itself that it has the subject matter jurisdiction required for standing?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the court did in fact satisfy itself that it that there was a plaintiff did have the legal standing to maintain the claim under the Maritime Lien Act.
And this goes to the fact that the district court has said it wasn't material as to whether Addicks assigned the materials, the receivables. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
It suffered an injury in fact when it provided the vessel with the fuel, but did not receive full compensation.
That's correct, Your Honor. Under the Maritime Lien Act, a party providing necessaries to a vessel on order of the owner or a person authorized by the owner has a maritime lien on the vessel and may bring a civil action in rem to enforce the lien and is not required to allege or prove that credit was given to the vessel. In this
case, so that's the standing that they have. That's standing.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Under
the law. And so when the other side maintained that you had assigned the receivables, what they were doing, as Judge Keenan said a few minutes ago, I'm just catching on, is that they're making an argument that your client is not the real party in interest, right? Because they've now assigned...
That seems to be their argument. But again, there's right. No evidence. A notation on an invoice is not evidence that there was an actual assignment. There's actually no evidence.
That's not a question of jurisdiction, though.
Right.
Because, okay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Do you have anything else you want to tell us?
No, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, Addicks rest. And thank you to Your Honors for your time today.
I just want to be sure that my colleagues have no further questions. Judge Agee?
No further.
Judge Keenan?
Nothing, thanks.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Bessie.
The other side has reserved some time for rebuttal. If you have any rebuttal, we'll be happy to hear it.
Yes, Your Honor, I do have some time for rebuttal. I would like to make the point that I think the district court, despite saying that he couldn't determine one way or the other whether there was an actual assignment of the right of the maritime lien. Maritime liens are assignable under U.S. law. Assuming there was a lien that existed at the time the fuel was supplied, under the terms of the agreement, we are arguing, the express terms of the invoice, that lien, we believe it was assigned because that is typical of the factoring agreement that is in place with these banks that lend money. The banks themselves want to hold the rights to the liens and the rights to collect the debts. That is exactly what was determined in more than 30 cases around the country over the last 4 years, including the Barcliff versus MVB Blue case, that when Addicks, who is the seller, finances the purchase of the fuel, immediately upon supply under the financing agreements, the maritime lien is transferred over, including the right to collect a debt. In other words, the lien follows the debt because the banks want to have that right. So we do need to...
Interject a quick question. This is Judge Agee again. The Addicks could have bifurcated its rights. It could have retained the maritime lien and assigned the receivables rights, couldn't it?
No, absolutely not. That would allow that would create the absurd result that we have detailed in our brief. In other words, you would have Addicks go arrest the vessel, collect the full amount of the lien, which is the fuel supply price, and then you would have the bank going and chasing the purchaser for the other amount, thereby effectively paying twice the value of fuel from two different parties. This is exactly what the 30 cases in the OW group litigation around the country have ultimately resolved, that there is no two claims. The two claims in rem and in personam are intertwined because you cannot go and chase two different parties, for one for an in rem claim and the in personam for an in personam claim, and then have them to pay two different people, for example, addicts who claims to hold the lien and the bank who claims the right to collect the debt. So that is not a possible scenario, which is why
they have brought the in rem claim and collected. Wouldn't the obligor have an absolute defense that it already paid once?
Yeah.
No, because remember,
pay twice.
Yeah. Remember, remember the obligor is Windrose. Windrose would not have paid once. It would have been another party that would have paid. So that's exactly the problem here, is that when you arrest the vessel claiming that it's totally unrelated to the contract, and or in this case the settlement agreement, that you have an independent in rem claim that you could pursue and collect fully, the obligor is not the vessel. The obligor is Windrose. The vessel is merely the subject of an in rem claim. There, in no way can you consider the vessel an obligor. It is simply by operation of U.S. law. And again, U.S. law only applies here because it was included in a contract to which the vessel owner was not a party, which again, raises serious questions as to whether U.S. law should apply at all, since there are no connections to the supply of fuel in the United States between U.S. entities or U.S. flagged vessels. But that being said, it is imperative, and which is why we understood the language of the contracts to clearly mean that the receivables, including the debts and the rights and the liens, if any, were assigned. That's what it says on the invoice. We take Addicts' word for it.
But so aren't you, Mr. Power, aren't you also required to take Addicts' word and its agreement in this case that it does not have a right to double recovery? It just seems to me that what you're trying to say is because what the 30B6 witness said was essentially a boilerplate statement without any other evidence. You're trying to transform that into an assignment when we have no evidence as to who was the assignee. We don't know anything, but we do know that the Swiss bankruptcy proceeding was settled as to Addicts and Windrose. Windrose agreed to pay a lot of money, and suggesting that there wasn't as an assignment. So there's more evidence that there wasn't an assignment, at least circumstantially in this case, than there is that there actually was an assignment. So,
I'm just
troubled that you're telling us what banks usually do in other cases when this record is just really bereft of evidence of an assignment, other than that one boilerplate statement that the district court didn't find sufficient to carry the day.
Well, Your Honor, I mean that receivable in the express language. I'm sorry, that invoice in the express language on there is really no different than the contract, you know, which says, well, an assignment has been made. I mean, if that document was produced, I don't think, you know, the court would say there's no evidence that an assignment's been made. So we have one contractual document, which is the invoice, which says receivables were assigned to somebody else. So I do think there is ample evidence on the record that when you assign a receivable, I believe, You cannot retain the maritime lien. I do not believe as a matter of law that is possible. So you must infer, absolutely must infer, by the express language used by Addicts itself in its own invoice, submitted at the outset of this arrest action, that it has assigned the receivables and along with it, under operation of law, the maritime lien. Because you cannot retain a lien and assign the right to collect the debt.
Well, I don't understand how we could just assume that. I would assume to me at least it would be your burden of proof. I'm not sure that your argument goes anywhere, but at least you would have to establish it. The district court said you hadn't established it.
I think the court said he didn't know one way or the other because he hadn't made a legal determination.
That means you haven't established it. I don't know. How do you translate that as you have established it?
Well, again, the burden is not on me to prove a negative. The document itself speaks for itself. When you transfer a receivable to another party by operation of law, I don't have to prove it. It is the law requires it. that the lien follows the debt. 100%, it cannot be otherwise. Otherwise, it will lead to the absurd result where two parties are being chased to pay the same debt to two different people, which is exactly what the OWC
is. Yeah, but Mr. Power, this is Judge Keenan. Well, isn't it absurd for us to accept the proposition that Windrose would agree to pay Addix $300,000+ if Addix had already assigned that lien to a third party? I mean, that's what you're, it seems like your argument's built on the house of cards.
Yeah.
If you want us to believe that Windrose agreed to pay that money, even though Addix had assigned the lien to a third party. Why is that a reasonable proposition?
Well, Your Honor, it's exactly the same reason for Windrose believed that when it was paying under the settlement agreement, Windrose had no reason to believe that Addix would go out and arrest the vessel seeking the same debt. In other words,
right.
Windrose had already...
Yes, but Mr. Power, if Addix had already assigned it to the third party, why would Windrose be agreeing to sell out $300,000+ to someone who wasn't the real party in interest?
Well, remember, just because you assign a lien and the right to collect the debt, that wasn't something that Windrose was looking to satisfy its obligation to the entity that it entered a contract with, right? Windrose could reasonably believe, and again, I don't know if the representations by Addix were truthful. Certainly they represented that the debt was clear and we were not going to pursue anything and we've released you so long as you pay us the $20,000, we won't take any other action. They took action even before the settlement agreement was breached. So, again, I wasn't there. I didn't negotiate. I think it's pure speculation, and I don't think for this particular case there should be any great focus in what's going on in the Swiss bankruptcy proceeding or what Windrose might have believed was the basis for the rights for it to enter into a settlement agreement with Addix. Addix may very well have represented it has the authority to enter into a settlement agreement to clear the debt and extinguish the lien. And again, it seems clear that that's probably what they did represent because Windrose agreed to enter into a settlement agreement and begin paying money. When the vessel was arrested prior to the breach of the settlement agreement, right, immediately after the $20,000, I think what we see here is that Addix has acknowledged that the settlement agreement is absolutely governing over whether or not there's a maritime lien because they reduced their maritime lien claim by the $20,000 paid under the settlement. So, again, I really think that the settlement agreement is the penultimate contract which the court should look to, and all the rights that are available to Addix, to the extent they weren't already assigned, should be purely governed by the settlement agreement.
Okay. Let me just follow up on one aspect of my earlier question, Mr. Power. The assignment language was on an invoice that was issued to Windrose. So Windrose knew when it was settling and agreeing to pay $300,000+ that this assignment purportedly had been made. And
yeah.
You're saying that Windrose was agreeing to pay $300,000+, notwithstanding the fact that the invoice that was the subject of the Addix-Windrose dispute had this language saying that an assignment had been made.
Yeah, because I think of course, the Addix had the apparent authority to make a settlement under this, whether it was on behalf of itself or someone else, it's irrelevant. The Addix had the apparent authority, just like Addix states that the charterer, not the vessel owner, had apparent authority to bind the vessel. It's no different. There are people that represent themselves to have authority to settle a debt, right? So Addix could simply be the agent on behalf of the person that had assigned the receivables and the lien to exercise the right to enter into a settlement agreement to settle the debt. We don't know that either.
Yeah, so I'm going to sell out $300,000+ because, hey, this plaintiff might actually be the real party in interest. Could be, despite that assignment language. That just seems to be a very impractical.
I think it didn't matter at the time, and it makes sense that it wouldn't matter to Windrose. If Windrose were entering into a settlement agreement, okay, such that settlement of the agreement would bind not only Addix, but any entity in which Addicts had authority to act as agent who had the right to collect the lien or the debt, that, it wouldn't matter. There's no one suggesting that Addicts didn't have apparent authority to settle a debt if, in fact, it itself was owed the debt, or that debt was owed by the very party that it assigned the receivables to. I wouldn't read anything into the fact that Winrose thought it was appropriate under the circumstances to settle with the party that it had contracted with, right? It has nothing to do with an acknowledgement, implicit, express, or otherwise, that Winrose was admitting that the assignment of a receivable was not made for the maritime lien to someone else. Only that debt, that settlement of the debt precluded any further action to collect the debt or the maritime lien either by Addicts or any other party.
Counsel, can you give me a case which supports your view that an assignment of the receivables automatically assigns the maritime lien? You haven't briefed this, so there's nothing in your brief that says that.
Yeah, I think certainly the Barclays versus MVD Blue case, because they looked at the language of the assignment, and they said when you assign the debt, you assign the maritime lien goes with it. So we did
they say that it automatically, any assignment of the debt automatically assigns the maritime lien. That's what I'm looking for, a case that says that.
Well, I think it's just implicit in these cases. I think what
why?
I think.
Maritime lien is a very peculiar animal.
Well, no, it is a peculiar animal, but what has been universally held by the courts is that they're not two separate claims. You can't pursue the in rem independently from an in personam and collect on both claims. The claims intertwine.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean that assignment of one, the assignment of the receivables, means that you've assigned the other. You can't collect twice, to be sure. Thank you. I appreciate your answer. My colleagues, do you have any further questions? Okay. I think you've well exceeded the time for your rebuttal. Thank you very much, both of you. We appreciate your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We will adjourn to court, and our clerk will get us ready for the next case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Have a nice day.
The court will take a brief break before hearing the next case.